Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Got a good mix of articles, so let's get into it. And first, I'm going to start with the must list. Andor Season 2, Amy Sherman-Palladino's Étoile, and David Cronenberg's The Shrouds top this week's must list. Penn Bagley returns in Netflix's You, and a new memoir by Tina Knowles, a.k.a. Beyoncé's mama, round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. It hasn't been a good few days for TV characters. After last week's 911 shocker, The Last of Us said, "Hold my golf club." Entertainment Weekly was on set for that harrowing episode, which you can read all about in our latest cover story by Nick Romano. Can we make it a week without some TV tragedy, please? I'm listening to David Archuleta's Creme Brulee on repeat as a palate cleanser. That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. So the first item on the list is Andor. Season 2 of Disney Plus's Rogue One prequel series is in full swing as Diego Luna's titular Star Wars character inches closer to his inevitable fate on Scarif. The seeds of rebellion continue to be planted, with multiple storylines weaving together intense standoffs that will keep both Imperials and Agitators on edge. Upcoming episodes 8 through 10 are especially fantastic, and a special shout-out to Season 2 secret weapon Elizabeth Dulau as Luthen's steely assistant Kleya, who could stare down Darth Vader and live to tell the tale. Next, we have Étoile. Amy Sherman-Palladino and husband Dan Palladino trade jokes for jetés with this Prime Video series set in the high-stakes world of professional ballet. Luke Kirby and Charlotte Gainsbourg star as the heads of two ballet companies who decide to swap dancers and choreographers. Matriarch. Tina Knowles, a mother almost as well-known as her superstar daughters Beyoncé and Solange, penned a memoir about resilience, creativity, and what it took to raise women who not only live in their power, but create culture. No wonder it's an Oprah's book club pick. The Shrouds. David Cronenberg's 23rd film significantly enriches the grave and enigmatic spiritual inquiry the Canadian auteur first opened in 2005's A History of Violence, nearly completing his career-long migration from questions of the body to questions of the soul. You, ready to go one final round with Joe Goldberg? Penn Bagley's love-obsessed serial killer returns to New York and Netflix with a new wife and new money, but the same old murderous tendencies as the ghosts of his past seek justice. Those are all the items on the must list this week. Andor Season 2, Amy Sherman-Palladino's Étoile, and David Cronenberg's The Shrouds top this week's must list, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. We have one review. It's a TV review. The Rehearsal. Nathan Fielder takes a flyer in sharp, strange new season. The comedian takes on commercial aviation disasters in Season 2 of his HBO docu-comedy. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Season 1 of The Rehearsal, the semi-unscripted docu-series conceived and executed by comedian Nathan Fielder, began as an exercise meant to help people practice and perfect tough conversations they needed to have with loved ones. Using HBO's budget to build elaborate, meticulously detailed sets that replicated real-life locations, Fielder put his subjects through extensive role-playing drills to determine the best possible way to approach their particular situation. If you plan for every variable, Fielder explained in the series premiere, a happy outcome doesn't have to be left to chance. It was a perfectly Fielderian premise, strange, deliberate in its excess, thought-provoking, ripe with possibilities for awkward interactions, and when the comedian stuck to the rehearsal's stated mission, it was fascinating. But season one degenerated into self-indulgent performance art when Fielder chose to place himself at the center of the action as part of an extended exploration of his readiness to be a parent. Now the rehearsal is back, and Fielder seems to have learned from his mistakes. The new season, it airs Sundays at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time on HBO, maintains a more cohesive focus. In this case, developing a method to improve commercial aviation safety without sacrificing the show's signature weirdness. Though Fielder allows himself some tangents in season two, he lets the show's concept shine, using mind-boggling production design, psychological engineering, and genuine comedy to answer a very relatable question. Why is it sometimes so hard to say what we really feel? In the premiere, Fielder informs us that he's been studying commercial aviation disasters, and he's noticed what he calls a quote-unquote pattern. As he explains to John Goglia, the former president of the National Transportation Safety Board, poor communication between pilots and their first officers, also known as co-pilots, seems to be a key factor in several of the crashes he studied. Years ago, Goglia himself once recommended that the Federal Aviation Administration use role-playing to help first officers learn to assert themselves in crisis situations, but the FAA didn't act on the suggestion. Enter Fielder with a proposal. What if he used the rehearsal to let first officers practice having honest, life-or-death conversations with their pilot bosses? I've always believed if you rehearsed long enough and hard enough, he explains, nothing will be left to chance. The joke is twofold. HBO gave Fielder a budget to make a comedy series, and any significant change to federal aviation policy requires an act of Congress. So not only must Fielder find a way to make the concept of near-miss plane crashes funny, but he also needs to get U.S. senators to take him seriously, despite being the guy known for stunts like dumb Starbucks and poo-flavored frozen yogurt. As the comedian himself muses, I was both the best and worst person to solve this problem. Fielder loves a challenge, especially one of his own making, and he finds entertaining ways to explore the complicated power dynamics that first officers encounter in the cockpit. After getting to know a Houston-based co-pilot named Moody, Fielder begins coaching him to be more open with his long-distance girlfriend, in hopes that those skills could translate to his day job. In the season's funniest maneuver, Fielder, who started his career as a producer on Canadian Idol, creates an aviation-themed singing competition to get first officers, who serve as the judges, comfortable with saying no. Whether helping struggling businesses in Nathan For You or improving aviation training in the rehearsal, Fielder likes to put problem-solving at the center of his comedy, but he prefers to take the most unexpected, and sometimes inconvenient, approach to every obstacle, both for comedic effect and to keep the viewer guessing. An episode may begin with aspiring singers performing Amazing Grace in hopes of advancing to the next round of a fake reality show, and end with Fielder discussing anti-Semitism with a German actor who's dressed like a Nazi. The latter digression, which I won't spoil other than to say it's related to Nathan For You, is hilarious, and Fielder manages to connect it to the overall theme of the season. Other times, though, the detours seem to be engineered solely for the purpose of indulging Fielder's weirdest whims and, of course, spending HBO's money on ornate and bizarre rehearsal sets. At one point, Fielder claims he wants to investigate whether it's possible to execute a personality transfer with a well-known pilot by recreating key moments of that pilot's life. It's unlikely the comedian really believes he can absorb another individual's personality traits through role-playing, but if it allows him to be on camera in an oversized crib while wearing a cloth diaper, who cares? This wasn't a performance for you, the viewer, Fielder assures us via voiceover. It was an experience for me. Doubtful. Fielder, who also says he believes sincerity is overrated, directs all 6 episodes of the rehearsal, and he's credited as one of 4 writers, alongside Carrie Kemper, Adam Locke Norton, and Eric Notarnicola. As in season 1, it's not always easy to tell when the actors Fielder has hired for the rehearsal are improvising and when they're performing dialogue that he's provided to them. What is clear is that we're only seeing what Nathan Fielder wants us to see. Though some of his antics ring hollow, did Fielder really think building 5 exact replicas of a co-pilot's studio apartment would help him with his dating life, or did it just look cool on screen? This season of the rehearsal offers legitimate insight on some important ideas about this unfortunately very timely subject. Due to strict requirements surrounding their medical certification, many pilots are reluctant or unwilling to admit any struggles with anxiety, depression, or other mental health challenges. As Fielder discovers, this can lead to a general reticence among pilots while on the job, which in turn makes it harder for co-pilots to feel comfortable speaking up when something goes wrong. In his search for a solution, Fielder builds to a stunt that is a fantastically bad idea. Fans will expect nothing less. Of course, no matter how extraordinary the lengths Fielder is willing to go to eliminate chance, it's an impossible goal. The unpredictable, intangible realities of life will never surrender to even our most rigorous preparation. Still, the comedian delivers a finale that is nail-biting, absurd, and in some ways, maddeningly ambiguous. In the final minutes of the episode, Fielder reaches a conclusion that's open to interpretation, one that either underscores or undermines his entire thesis. Perhaps the best way to explain it is through something the comedian says earlier in the season while discussing an observation about the co-pilots who participated in the show. I don't know what it means, but it's interesting. That's a review of the rehearsal. Nathan Fielder takes a flyer in Sharp, Strange New Season. It was by Kristen Baldwin, who's giving the show a grade of B+. Next, Jesse Plemons is going to play his former movie dad, Philip Seymour Hoffman's role in a Hunger Games prequel. Plemons will portray young Plutarch Heavensby, originated by the late Hoffman in the film franchise, in the upcoming Haymitch Abernathy prequel, Sunrise on the Reaping. This is by Jessica Wang. Jesse Plemons is heading to Panem. The Academy Award-nominated star has joined the Hunger Games prequel Sunrise on the Reaping as the younger version of a character originated by a familiar collaborator. Plemons has been cast as Plutarch Heavensby, played by the late and great Philip Seymour Hoffman in the original film franchise. Notably, Plemons previously starred opposite Hoffman as his on-screen son in Paul Thomas Anderson's 2012 psychological drama, The Master. Jesse is one of the most talented actors of his generation, with a proven record of picking his roles selectively, Aaron Westerman, co-president of Lionsgate Motion Picture Group, said in a statement. We're honored that he has chosen to bring his own take to one of the most fascinating figures in Panem, and feel that his previous collaboration with Philip Seymour Hoffman makes it all the more special. His Plutarch will be both a tribute to the character fans have already come to know and a portrayal he makes his own. The upcoming prequel centers on a teenage Haymitch Abernathy, originated by Woody Harrelson and to be played by Joseph Zeta in this iteration, as he's reaped for the 50th Hunger Games, otherwise known as the Second Quarter Quell. Plutarch, future head game maker of the 75th Hunger Games and commander of the rebel forces, is a young Capitol cameraman in this timeline who's tasked with documenting the tributes of District 12, and he's already got rebellion on his brain. Hoffman, who died in February of 2014, made his final on-screen appearance in the last two films of the franchise, The Hunger Games: Mockingjay, Part 1 and Part 2. Franchise director Francis Lawrence, who will return to helm the upcoming prequel, did not use CGI to complete Hoffman's remaining scenes, instead opting to rewrite the script and redistributing some of his dialogue to other characters. He was one of the greatest actors, I think, of all time, and I just think to try to fake a Philip Seymour Hoffman performance would have been catastrophic, and I never want to do that, Lawrence told HuffPost in late 2014. I just think this was the best way to be able to get around such a horrible thing. Plemons' most recent credits include Alex Garland's unnerving dystopian feature Civil War and Yorgos Lanthimos' surrealist dramedy Kinds of Kindness, as well as the miniseries Zero Day and anthology series Black Mirror. Whitney Peake has also been cast as Lenore Dove, Haymitch's girlfriend and a Covey descendant of none other than Lucy Gray Baird from the Coriolanus Snow prequel, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which was adapted into a film in 2023. Rachel Zegler played Lucy Gray, while Tom Blythe played a young Coriolanus Snow, originated by the late Donald Sutherland in the original film franchise. McKenna Grace has also joined as Maisely Donner, Haymitch's fellow District 12 tribute and ally. Ready to return to the arena? Sunrise on the Reaping arrives in theaters November 20th, 2026. That was Jesse Plemons to play his former movie dad Philip Seymour Hoffman's role in Hunger Games prequel. It was by Jessica Wang. We heard about The Pit last week and the season wrapped up recently. This is a story that says Noah Wyle on that tribute to his grandfather on The Pit, why making the show was a risk. The actor chats with Entertainment Weekly's The Awardist podcast about his return to the ER and why an ER reboot just didn't make the best sense. This is by Jared Hall. They say you can't go home again, but don't tell Noah Wyle that. Some 15 years after saying goodbye to ER, the series that made him a star and earned him 5 Emmy nominations in the process, not only did he return to the medical genre with the enormously popular and critically named Max series The Pit, on which he serves as an executive producer and writer of 2 episodes, but he did so on the Warner Brothers Studios lot, just 1 soundstage over from where the hit NBC series was filmed. But the memories, he says, came flooding back even before filming began. We did the 2 weeks of medical boot camp on stage 12, which faces stage 11, which is where we had done ER all those years, Wyle says on the latest episode of the Awardist podcast. So it's only about 100 feet, but it felt like 100 years and about 20 pounds and about 10 million memories. It's been the most synchronistic sense of completion and closure experience from the jump. On ER, which ran from September 1994 to April 2009, Wyle starred as a medical student, John Carter. On The Pit, he's Dr. Robbie Rabinovich, a senior attending physician in the emergency department at an underfunded and understaffed Pittsburgh trauma hospital. The series plays out over one day, each episode representing an hour of their shift. And where ER often focused on the patient's cases and the doctor's personal lives, the Pitt centers squarely on the medical professionals and the toll these cases, both past and present, take on them. During the pandemic, Wiley and ER executive producer and showrunner John Wells and co-executive producer R. Scott Gemmel started exploring the possibility of a reboot of ER, created by Michael Crichton. We were close enough that we were in the rights conversation with the Crichton camp that broke down, Wiley reveals, and that's how we got to where we are. Wiley acknowledges that a reboot would have been satisfying for ER fans, but the creative team realized it wasn't going to be easy to get the original cast back together. But more so, they wanted to move from 2020 forward, not go back to 93 and bring everybody up to 2020. Having starred on 254 episodes of a medical drama didn't deter Wiley from returning to the genre. In fact, he says, he was the one doing the arm twisting on this one a little bit in his attempt to convince Wells and Gemmel they should do it. Individually, we're at a point in our lives and careers where we wanted to punch above our weight class again and to reach for something that we weren't feeling like we'd touched in a while, he explains. Gemmel had just wrapped up a 14-season run as executive producer and showrunner of NCIS Los Angeles. And Wells didn't have anything else to prove in television, but he has a lot to lose when he puts his neck out there, especially in an arena where he's already established quite a bit of credibility, Wiley says. It's very easy to fall and almost disgrace your legacy if you don't land the plane elegantly, so we were very conscious of what we had to risk in this endeavor. He realized the risk was paying off when he saw an edit of the first episode. There was a lot of, and rightly so, speculation about whether or not using music was a good idea or a bad idea, or having actors be doing background in the scenes that they're not in. These are the things that sound good in concept, but you're not really sure if they're going to take something away from the dramatic punch when you put it all together, he explains. It wasn't until we saw it cut together and seeing that these cases really benefit from playing over multi-episodes. Audiences can remember where we are. In fact, they appreciate the fact that we're able to do a little bit of a deeper dive and play these things out in real time. If I say your labs are going to be back in an hour and I come back with the results of those labs, that's engaging and innovative in a way that we didn't appreciate was going to really work. But it has, and it validates the proof of concept, which really is encouraging going into season two. On this particular day in shift, it's the anniversary of the death of Dr. Robbie's mentor, Dr. Adamson, who died at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, a death Dr. Robbie carries a lot of guilt over. All the while, he and his team are saving lives while also, inevitably, losing some. A mass shooting at a Pittsburgh music festival results in multiple casualties, which play out in the season's final few episodes. Those were championship rounds. Those are the ones I was probably less fun to live with, Wiley says of the grueling shoot, as well as the emotional weight of the storyline, which results in Dr. Robbie having a private breakdown. It just was easier to stay in it than to try to come out of it. My wife and children were really compassionate and understanding and supportive all the way through. And I walked everybody through what I thought the process was going to be, and it was very similar to what I thought it was. My wife, to her credit, when I came out the other side, just said, "I'm sending you away to be away from humans and just flush." And so that's what she did. Earlier episodes packed emotional punches of different kinds, including episode 4, one of two that Wiley wrote. In it, a brother and sister, played by Mackenzie Astin and Rebecca Tilney, struggle to make an end-of-life decision about their elderly father, who's declining quickly as a result of a severe case of pneumonia. End-of-life care, how we ease people into these difficult decisions, how we depict the choices and the consequences of those decisions was really important. And I've gotten a lot of really lovely feedback from that episode in particular, as people have said that it helped them frame the experience for themselves or brought up having gone through it fairly recently and give them a little bit of grace and feeling seen and heard, Wiley says. In writing it, Wiley paid tribute to his grandfather. I called my mother, and I told her that I'd finished writing the scene where an adult sister and brother are saying goodbye to their father. And it reminded me of when she and my Uncle Sandy said goodbye to my grandfather, he recalls. And my mother said, "It was so funny. Right before Dad died, he opened his eyes and he said her mom's name. He said, Marge. And then he smiled and he just went away." Wiley took note and added that extra touch to the character's final moments. My mother, I was sitting next to her when she watched the episode, and that moment happened, and I thought, oh God, how's she going to feel? And she turned to me and she just smiled. She was so touched that that moment became that moment, which then apparently became a moment for a lot of other people. So the point is to make these connections. The point is to aim for hearts and connect them to each other. We can listen to Wiley's full interview on the Awardus podcast that's linked in the article, where he also reveals secrets of the practical effects team, explains Dr. Robbie's complicated emotional state, and looks back on his and George Clooney's guest starring roles on Friends and more. Plus, we discuss Nate Bargatze being named host of the 2025 Emmys. That was Noah Wiley on that tribute to his grandfather on the pit, Why Making the Show Was a Risk, and that was by Jared Hall. I'm going to take a quick moment here just to remind everybody that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, EW.com. Next, we have another new article from The Awardist. Hacks stars Jean Smart and Hannah Einbinder on their darker turn and taking risks on season 4. Plus, limited series Emmy nomination predictions and more in EW's The Awardist Digital Magazine. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff, but the article I'm reading here is the one from the Hacks stars. Why Jean Smart wasn't shocked Hacks won the Best Comedy Emmy, and why Hannah Einbinder was stoked to explore a throuple. This interview is by Jared Hall. After watching them betray and blackmail each other on season 3 of Hacks, it's a joy to walk into a room occupied by Jean Smart and Hannah Einbinder where there's no tension, just cheerful hellos, hugs, and a cup of jelly beans. Huddled together in a West Hollywood hotel for a day full of press ahead of the season 4 premiere of Hacks, the two have a lot to celebrate. Coming off an outstanding comedy series win at the 2024 Emmys, but they're also a bit guarded, careful not to say too much about what's to come on season 4, as Smart's Deborah Vance gets to live out her dream of hosting her own late-night show. With Ava as her head writer, whether she likes it or not. The big question, of course, is how, if at all, they can end their feud, much less be civil. So far this season, there have been practical jokes, the likes of which required mandatory sensitivity training for everyone on the late-night series, a public confrontation at a party thrown by media company CEO Bob Lipka, played by Tony Goldwyn, yep, the same one Deborah slept with in season 3 prior to landing the hosting job, a wild trip to Vegas, and more. Now the series welcomes comedy legend Carol Burnett playing herself in a fortuitous encounter with Deborah when she needs some life and career-saving advice. Grab some jelly beans and dig into Smart and Einbinder's conversation with the awardist as they look back on their big Emmys win, reflect on that season 3 finale shocker, and break down the action so far in season 4. The awardist asks, take me back to the Emmys and that best comedy win, scale of 1 to 10. How shocked were you? What were those feelings in the moment? Hannah Einbinder says, it was crazy. Jean Smart says, I was 10 in pleasure. I was not shocked at all. Einbinder, okay, say that. Smart says, I don't know why. I just thought I wasn't surprised at all that we won. I was surprised that everybody was surprised. Entertainment Weekly asks, was there a gut instinct, an intuition, something you felt? Smart says, frankly, I felt like the bear had had some, not controversy, but I mean, people had discussed so much the fact that it's a fabulous show, but is it a comedy? Who else were we up against? And Entertainment Weekly answers, Abbott Elementary, Only Murders in the Building. Smart says, love both those shows. Einbinder, love Abbott so much. Smart says, I do too, but I was, who beat us before? And Entertainment Weekly answers, the bear. Smart, the bear once. Einbinder, bear and Ted Lasso, perhaps. Smart says, oh, and Ted Lasso, but Ted's out of the picture. So Entertainment Weekly says, well, not anymore. And Einbinder says, they're coming back. And Smart says, they're coming back? And Entertainment Weekly confirms, season 4, it's official. Einbinder says, yeah, I was pretty surprised. I think I'm not in a place of expecting it. So I think I was surprised, but I was really stoked because I felt like we were getting so much love this season and all. But of course, this season, it felt like people were being really like, Smart jumps in saying, I think that was one of the reasons. People kept saying, oh my God, this is the best season yet. Entertainment Weekly says, well, obviously, lots of people were thrilled at that moment. Before we dig into season 4, let's go back to the very beginning. Hannah, what do you remember about your first day on set filming your first scripted series ever? Do you recall those emotions, whatever they might have been? Einbinder, I think we were on location and I was just trying to not get fired. I think I was like, let's sneak on by. I'll hide behind Jean. That'll help. And then I'll just be chill and they'll let me stay. So that was kind of my thought, really. And I was meeting Carl Clemens Hopkins for the first time. I met Mark in Delicato for the first time. And I believe it was the day we shot the Rolls Royce breaking down and Deborah taking the helicopter. And then perhaps even the pizza shop as well was our first day. Or perhaps that was the second day. Smart says it was. Einbinder, maybe it was the second day, but Smart says, when did we shoot the interview scene? Einbinder, the interview scene was much later. And Entertainment Weekly says, the job interview in Deborah's house? Einbinder, yes. The great thing was, I didn't really have time to be feeling much because I think the first week of my acting career, season 1 of Hacks, was a scene where I'm getting the sprinklers turned on me, a scene where a helicopter is taking off in the desert. I'm sweating with chocolate on myself. I have an intimate scene. I really had kind of like a crash course. Smart says, shot from guns. Einbinder, yeah, shot out of a cannon. I did a lot of the things that you ever do, kind of, in the first week. So just kind of survival and a huge inferiority complex, really insecure, really like, there's no way this is going to last. But yeah, hell yeah, made a lot of progress, I think. My therapist would agree, I think. We've definitely talked about that. Entertainment Weekly asks, was there still a lot of learning marks and all that kind of stuff? I'm Binder for sure. Learning truly everything. Crazy. They turn to Gene Smart and say, Gene, on the flip side, obviously not your first series when this started, but can you look back from now to season one and see in terms of your acting skills, is there anything different that you note about how this show has challenged, pushed you in your acting? Gene Smart responds, well, I mean, I just enjoy it so much. I enjoy this character so much. I remember the day that I met Paul and Jen and Lucia. I can't believe I was so cheeky. And we were just sitting across the table from each other and they had offered me the role. I knew that going in. And we met and sat down, pleasantries. And I said, well, you're right. I'm perfect for this part. Thank God they laughed. But it was everything. It checked every box. If someone had said, what would your ideal series be? What would your ideal character be in a series? And it checked every box. It was such a gift. Entertainment Weekly says, in the process, I think you've won every TV award out there that exists for your performance. Smart says, I had to sleep with a lot of people, let me tell you. Entertainment Weekly, sure. And in those regards, you've experienced some incredible highs with the series in the midst of some very personal lows. In the midst of all that, your husband passing a heart procedure last year, how did this show help you get through those things, knowing there's something to come back to? I have to imagine, in some ways, therapeutic that there was a cast and crew waiting for you when you were ready. Smart says, I felt a huge responsibility to the show, even though it was season one when I lost my husband. They could not have been kinder and more accommodating. I had 5 days of work left on season one when he died unexpectedly, and they said, we have to finish. I said, no, of course, I understand. They said, we could spread it out over a couple weeks. You could take a couple weeks off and then do it, or do it all at once right now. And I just said, no, let's just do it now. I think because I was still kind of in shock and I was getting through it until the second or third day, and it was the funeral scene for Ava's dad. And I don't have anxiety attacks in my life, but I definitely started to have one. And I said, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can do it. And I believe I took an Ativan and we did it. And it turned out to be really a lot of fun and a fabulous scene. Entertainment Weekly says, and fulfilling in a way you didn't expect, I presume. Smart says, I don't know. I try not to put too much meaning on those events, but yeah, it was really fun. I thought it was a brilliant scene, because I mean, who hasn't thought that when they've gone to a funeral? How many times have you sat there and they go, anybody want to get up and say anything about George? And people are like staring and looking around, and then it's just so awkward the longer the pause goes on. It should be structured in a much different way. So yeah, it probably was cathartic to a certain extent. And again, it was, I thought, a brilliant scene. I would love to do that if I had the guts at a funeral. Entertainment Weekly asks, well, as we start to get into season four, I'm curious, did you go back and watch season three? Was there anything you wanted to revisit of that before you dug into this season? Einbinder says, I only rewatched that final scene just because I love it, frankly, first and foremost, because it's so exhilarating to watch, but also because it really seamlessly flows into the first part of season four. And Smart says, it's amazing how seamless it was, since it was 6 months in between, something like that. Einbinder, yeah, maybe more. Entertainment Weekly, so far, the first four episodes have aired, and it's really been quite a roller coaster between Deborah and Ava. What have you enjoyed about getting to be at odds with each other? Because I know that the two of you are quite friendly. But when the cameras are on, what's the personal thrill in those kinds of scenes for you? Einbinder responds, well, it's fun when there's some verbal sparring that we get to do. And Smart says, well, this is a little more than sparring this year. I think part of the enjoyment is that we realized we were taking it to a new level. Not positive that it was going to go over with our audiences, but I had faith that it would. But it was definitely a darker turn we were taking, and I knew the writers would get us through it, but it was interesting to go that dark. Entertainment Weekly, but you felt risky, perhaps? Smart, a little bit. A little bit. Entertainment Weekly asks, was there a moment that feeling went away, saw where it was going, knew how it was going to play? Smart says, I like some of the practical jokes Deborah plays on her because then I felt like, okay, so that's still a little bit of the old dynamic. Einbinder says, that I have to say, just as an aside, the scene with myself and Dan Bukatinsky in the office is an all-timer. Dan is such a effing icon. He's so funny. You don't know who that man is. I'm like, because you're gay? He's like, Entertainment Weekly interrupts, you shouldn't assume that. Einbinder, you shouldn't assume sexual orientation. You have a picture of you marrying a guy in your office. You don't know who that man is. So funny. And it is fun to play the shock, surprise, embarrassment, and anger that leads to, of course, that big confrontation at Bob's party. But yeah, look, sometimes we have to really be serious in getting in an actual fight and there's no levity whatsoever, and that's definitely intense. But I think Jean earlier said, like, it's easy to do those scenes because we have such a good relationship. I think if we weren't so solid, it'd be a little like, ooh, is this real? Smart, very uncomfortable. Entertainment Weekly, if we're listing the pros and cons to those scenes, is there anything in the con column about those scenes? Smart says, only if they hadn't worked. Entertainment Weekly, indeed. But I think what's so great about what we've seen so far is there's such an unpredictability to the proceedings. I feel like at any moment something can happen. There's such a beautiful tension that's been built here, and obviously you can feel tension, but the unpredictability of it. Can you feel that in the moment as you're working through these moments? Einbinder, yeah. Smart, I think so. And definitely when we read the script for the first time, because I like to be surprised. I don't want to know what's coming, but no risk, no reward. That's why this show has been going so well. Einbinder, and half the time, we don't really rehearse. We'll just go right in with the cameras up and work the scene out as it comes. So we find a lot there. And Lucia obviously has a huge influence on our performances, and so we're able to really have everything fresh and in the instant. Smart, she knows exactly what she wants. Entertainment Weekly, what do each of you think is at the core of this dynamic? Is there intimidation, naivete, fear of being alone? What is really for each of them? What keeps them like this? Einbinder, it's, I think, their sense of humor. I think it's the level they connect on. It's a frequency that few people can tap into. It's like a language that only they speak. Their way of connecting is through humor. And it is so potent. And there's also the element of Ava not having a great relationship with her mom, and DJ and Deborah not having the best relationship, where they're able to kind of live that out with each other. Smart says, I marvel at the writing because until you said that moment just now, I thought, well, of course that's right. You have a dysfunctional relationship with your mother. I have a dysfunctional relationship with my daughter. So it's kind of puzzle pieces that are meant to go together. And I think that is a lot of, yes, definitely, the sense of humor. I know that if somebody makes me laugh or if somebody gets my humor like that, I'm halfway in love. It's just a very special thing, and I look forward to scenes where we can make each other laugh again instead of cry. Entertainment Weekly says, last year, there was an episode, you and I talked about this a bit when you and Caitlin Olson were on the podcast with me, her big scene, the roast. You didn't particularly like the word that she uses, but you say it this season. Was there any, like, wringing arms, pulling, anything? Smart. She's laughing. Oh, it was so much fun. Entertainment Weekly. Oh, you leaned in? Smart. I did. Einbinder. It was so good. You were being so mean. Smart. I did. Einbinder. Yeah. Why don't you ask that little C what happened? It's so good. Smart. I thought that was a brilliant choice for Caitlin because she thinks that this is going to be funny. And of course, we're all looking at her going, oh my God, she's going to bomb. She runs it by her. It's like, you sure you want to? It's like, oh my God, this girl doesn't know what she's doing. And she kills. Perfect. Hacks flip. Entertainment Weekly. And I'm just now remembering when we had that conversation that I had said, you know, though, it makes sense because it's probably a word she heard her mom say a lot. And we've finally get, Smart interrupts, no, but I don't think Deborah talks that way very often. Entertainment Weekly, you really have to piss her off. Smart, and I save it for Ava. Entertainment Weekly, and Hannah, you call her Bitchabod Crane. Smart, I love that. Oh my God. Einbinder, Bitchabod Crane up here. So funny. Entertainment Weekly, at the end of the first episode, the photo shoot and that exchange between you, you broke my heart. You broke mine first. The second it's done, I'll never speak to you again. Good. The fact that neither of you get to look at each other during that moment, it's kind of chilling. It gave me goosebumps. Smart says, I think it was brilliant that they staged it that way. It's sort of like when you have a conversation with someone, one of you is driving, one of you is in the back seat. It's like they say, if you ever want to have a deep conversation with your teenager, have them in the back seat. You drive, they'll spill their guts. But they won't if they're looking at you or sitting next to you. But there's something much more impactful about it for some reason having to say it quietly to each other because they're in a room full of people. And I think it's absolutely sincere on both their parts. Einbinder, oh my God, I was so devastated. That was one of those ones where it really did feel super visceral shooting that, like I really did feel that in the depths of my being. Entertainment Weekly, there are some good laughs here in the midst of all that tension. The Vegas episode is just a riot. The racetrack, poker, strip club, getting detained and put in handcuffs. But now wait, have you ever had a lap dance, Jean? Smart says, no. Entertainment Weekly, oh, so that was a first. Smart, I was offered one once by a gal, but politely declined. Einbinder, and Lindsay, the actress who gave Jean a lap dance, is in Enora. Smart, I just found that out. Einbinder, yes, she's a queen. Entertainment Weekly, Lauren Weedman, by the way, she's always funny, but this particular episode, hysterical. Entertainment Weekly, there are some really brilliant moments there. Speaking of brilliant, the panic attack. Not just that the panic attack happened, but who helps Deborah through the panic attack? In episode 4, the lovely Carol Burnett. Now, you've worked with Carol before on Hot in Cleveland, where she played your mom, but this one had different meaning for you? Smart. Very. And that was so long ago. It was such a treat to have her. There's nobody like her in terms of comedy and just being an incredibly cool human being. If I can be like her or Betty White when I'm in my 90s, I'll be a very, very happy lady. Einbinder. I was there that day watching at monitors, watching the scene, and it was really cool to see Deborah being like the little sis for once. Smart. Yeah, looking up to somebody. Tell me what to think. Einbinder. It was really cute. Smart. I'm having stage fright for the first time in my life. She wouldn't admit that to anybody except somebody like Carol Burnett. Entertainment Weekly asks, have either of you ever had stage fright? Smart. Oh, terrible. Entertainment Weekly. It's something that used to happen or you still have it? Smart. Well, we'll find out. I'm going to do a play in New York this summer. Haven't been on stage for a while, but yeah, it was debilitating for a little while. It's a terrible feeling. Einbinder. It's really horrible. I definitely have had it. I'm always nervous before a show, for sure. But for me, it melts the second I get out there. I just see the faces. Entertainment Weekly. What's so brilliant about that moment, though, is the advice and how it plays out. I should have seen it coming. Who the one person is she focuses on and does the show for. And that's one of those moments where I'm talking about that roller coaster of the season, that it's like they're at odds, but then you get that and you're like, ugh, come on, you two. Like rallying. We want these two to find their way. And you wonder, like, will either of them ever get out of their own way? Is that a fair assessment of where we might see things continue from here? Can they get out of their own way? Smart. That's a good question. Einbinder. I think that is the hope for these characters. I think whether or not they do is to be seen. And Smart says, because the thing is, they have now finally kind of been raw with each other, where there's really no kind of going back from that. Even if they still bicker or fight or have a misunderstanding or something, there's no going back. What do I need to do to apologize? What do I need to do to make this okay? I just risked my life trying to save a total stranger because I thought it was you. Referring there to a scene we will get to in a future episode, it's incredible. Hannah, in addition to all of the mayhem, Ava becomes part of a throuple. How it starts at the pleasure chest with you waving around a dildo, but when you found out this was going to be a thing for her, what were you most curious about with this relationship? Einbinder, I think how we would explore it in the show. I never could have guessed that we would meet at the pleasure chest, but I was really pleased with how it turned out. There are a couple crew members of ours who are polyamorous, and they were really stoked about the storyline. So I was really happy to hear that from them, especially. I think it was really beautifully done. I think it was really true to life and cool. And I also think it's interesting to turn on its head of, like, Ava's actually the one who's kind of doing this to get off, and these people are actually interested in something beyond sex, which I think is a really important thing to represent because I think that's true for a lot of people. So yeah, I was stoked that we handled it the way we did. Entertainment Weekly says, we touched on Carol Burnett as a guest star. Also this season, Jimmy Kimmel, Randy Newman, Julianne Nicholson coming up, and more to come. It seems a bit of an embarrassment of riches this season because I wondered going in how much we would see of Deborah interviewing guests. But what I kind of love is that there's very little of it. Smart says, it's a very high compliment that so many people want to be on the show. Entertainment Weekly, And it's for very important reasons that people like Jimmy are on. Smart says, oh my God, the stuff he said. I don't know if they put it in this one line he has. It's so shocking. Entertainment Weekly, I didn't know he had it in him, that entire scene. Smart, I didn't either. He's one of the sweetest men in the world, but he's just so damn funny. And he was having a good time. He was nervous at first, and then he just had a blast. Entertainment Weekly says, Gene, break a leg on Broadway. Hannah, what are you looking forward to this summer? Einbinder says, I'm going to do a movie. I can't say anything else. There's a note here that this interview has been edited for clarity and length, and we can listen to the full interview with Smart and Einbinder on the Awardist podcast that's linked in the article. And thank goodness they edited it because we are out of time for this episode. This has been Entertainment Weekly, and I've been reading from their website, which is EW.com. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury. Thank you for listening this week. Please come back next week to hear what I found from Entertainment Weekly's website. Until next week, goodbye.